Okay, this morning we're going to be finishing up on the deeds of the flesh, and the only one we have left is envy in our list of sins pertaining to one another. And as we see, these have kind of built one upon the other, and they all kind of, if you have one, if you don't have the other, you're going to get it pretty quick, because that's just the way these sins are. One turns into another, because very rarely do we just have one area. We can't just be jealous without being envious, and it's hard to be envious without turning into jealousy. So let's look at Philippians chapter 1. And Lauren, would you read verse 15 through 17, please?
Some of these preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains. But the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel.
Okay. Did you read verse 17? Yes. Okay. Yours just reads different from mine, so I have a hard time keeping up. You have New King James, right? Okay. Here, Paul, there were some people who were willing to preach the gospel, even though they didn't believe it, because they were envious of Paul and to cause him trouble. And so this is what envy causes us to do. Envy, you know, it doesn't just stop with being envious of somebody. It follows through that we're going to try to hurt them in some way so many times. Sin is a progressive thing. And in Mark chapter 15, Amanda, would you read verse 10, please?
Well, he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of
envy. So Pilate knew. You know, he could find nothing wrong with Jesus. But he knew that they had handed him over just because they were envious of him. And so envy is a very ugly and progressive thing. What did you find for a definition? Okay. Anybody else?
Resentful awareness of another's advantage.
Okay. You know, when we really define a word, does it really sound very pretty? You know, envy doesn't sound that bad, but when you really start trying to understand what it means, it makes people look bad, and yet we don't, you know, we don't stop and think of those things. We get caught up in our emotion and in what we want. Let's look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. Here Peter is writing, and he tells them in verse 1 that they're to put aside certain things. And it's interesting how these words go together. He said all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all slander. So all of these things kind of go together. So when you start being envious of somebody and having these issues, it just kind of grows and grows. So many times it's because we didn't like the person in the beginning. If we don't like somebody, it's real easy to be envious of them. So we need to guard our heart to be sure. You know, there are people that we enjoy more than other people, but when we just get an attitude... Do you ever know somebody that no matter what they know a person and they can never say anything good about that person? It's always negative. Once we turn to be negative, it's real easy to, you know, anything they want, we don't want them to have it. We're envious of that. We want it. Why should they have that? Look what they are. And we can list all their negative points. Someone told me one time, and this happens even among brethren, if you're praying for somebody, it's real hard to have evil feelings toward them, to be envious, to be jealous, to be hateful. If you're truly praying and asking God to bless this person, maybe they have a need that needs to be, maybe they're ill, or maybe they're having struggles with their children, or if they're just a brother or a sister, If you just pray for them and ask God to bless them, how can you turn around and want to hurt them and be envious of them and have these attitudes? Okay, anybody, is there any other comments on envy?
One of the things that I found that it had to do with spite, and spite's not a pretty word either, and we don't want to think that we do things out of spite, but people who are envious, they tend to turn, you know, they work at that envy, and they do things, and it's normally to annoy or threaten or to, you know, cause harm to the person, and it's just to clear out the spite.
It's not just awareness that somebody has, you know, something you don't or an advantage that you don't. It's the feelings that produces, like, you know, the resentfulness and the displeasure, you know, and the sometimes anger out by, you know, at least with my comment, that it provokes in us.
Yes, it is. And, you know, who in here wants to think of themselves as envious? I'm sure there's been a circumstance in all of our lives that we can look back on and think, I didn't have the right attitude toward that person. And maybe it was because of my envy that I didn't have the right attitude. Maybe they had something I wanted. Maybe they had a friend I wanted to be as close to as they were or something. So, that's right. It's a package deal.
And when it's word, so quick to find fault. If another person is or has or has had advantages, you know, that we have had, if there means if we tend to picnic, nitpick everything, you know, it's not just, you know, but just really, well, you this and you that and you everything, it just colors our whole attitude.
And it can be on either end of the spectrum. You don't have to be poor to be envious. You know, there are rich people who are envious of people who have something they don't have, and so it can happen no matter where you are on the social spectrum. It doesn't matter what it is, where you are. Okay, anything else?
Maybe, I don't know if it's called envy or all of these, but like you said, you can always find something even if you know that you're doing something kind, you can turn it around and go, oh, just do it because it's just that. And, you know, I've had to catch myself, you know, why are they doing it? But why do I do something? You know, all of them, I don't know, you can turn things around without knowing the situation for the reason that you're doing it, just because you're jealous.
That's the case with a lot of these words. And that's why we need to judge our own heart. We want to judge others the way we want God to judge us. And that's the scary thing for me is, you know, when I get maybe a bad attitude about somebody or something that's maybe not going the way I think it should, and, you know, I can get on my high horse and think, well, you know, I could fix this if they'd just ask me, which is not true at all. But that's how God, the way I judge others and the way I look at other people is how God's going to judge me. And that's scary because I want him to be very merciful to me. So we need to work very hard on being merciful to others and not being envious of them, whatever their position is. Because you're right, we don't know why people do stuff. And just like the people that we read about that were preaching the gospel, Paul wasn't upset about that. He said, good, the gospel's being preached. That's a good thing. And he moved on. He could have been very angry. You know, he could have added a whole lot to his list. But we need to rejoice. If they're doing good, we need to rejoice for the good that is being done, no matter what their motives are. Anybody else? Okay, we're going to start looking at three words now that we won't spend a whole lot of time on because I don't really think that is something that is a problem here, but we do need to look at these and realize that while you're out there, would you pull the rug and be sure the door's locked? Thank you. It's not something that this group, as far as I know, is very involved in, but we need to know what this means and how to teach people not to become involved in these things, because especially those of us with young children they're going to be faced. They're going, when they hit teenage years, drunkenness and drinking is going to be something that they are introduced to. Their friends are going to do it. I think Steve mentioned in a lesson here not too many months ago that Michael, who is just turned 14, has had some boys approach him about coming to a drinking party. And so these are things that we need to be aware of and teach our children about, and why, what's wrong with them and why it's not a good thing. We're going to look at drunkenness first. And the reason I put Acts 2 is not because these men were drunk, but it shows a little bit something about drunkenness. There's something about drunkenness that people thought of here on the day of Pentecost. Betty Yoakum, would you read Acts chapter 2, verse 13 through 15, please?
But others were mocking and saying, "They are fools, we find." But Peter, taking his stand with the 11, raised his voice and declared to them, "Men of Judea, and all you who live in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give ear to my words. For these men are not drunk as you suppose, for it is only the third hour of the day."
Okay, so these men were speaking in tongues, and I guess they thought they were acting weird, strange. Have you ever seen somebody drunk and their speech is slurred? You don't understand what they're saying. So they assumed, y'all just been drinking. Y'all been hitting the bottle real early. But that was not the case. So we need to think about that when we see someone drinking and know that their behavior is different. And this is a thing that we can use with our children. You may not realize how much you've drunk, or how, you know, if you drink, if you try something, and everybody it's different. But at what point do you become drunk, and at what point are you no longer in control? What were some of the definitions that you got for drinking or drunkenness? Okay.
Being intoxicated with alcoholic liquor to the point of impairment of physical and mental faculties. Okay. Mind is the opposite of sober, and so you've got to look up sober, and that serious in mind expression, not affected by passion, not drunk. And so often, man, you get us slobbering drunk. I mean, you've known people. I've seen people who are just in the social drinking atmosphere. They get loud. They get. They might say things they don't normally say. I mean, they're just not falling down drunk, you know, like the drunk in the gutter. But they have lost their sober-mindedness. They have lost their ability to make rational, you know, judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
let's look at 1 Peter 4. That was my next question. What do we think of as the opposite of being drunk? And that is sober. And soberness is talked about over and over again in the scriptures. And we're just going to look at two places here. Susan, would you read 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3 and 4 and verse 7?
The time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousal, drinking parties, and abominable idolatry. And in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer.
When someone is drinking, even if they're drinking socially, drinking casually, drinking what they consider very little, what does that do to their sober-mindedness? Does that impair their judgment in any way? I've not done research on this, but some of the things that I've heard is that it doesn't take but maybe one can of beer or one small glass of wine to impair some people's judgment. As far as their thinking, they just don't think as clearly. And, of course, from what we see, the legal limit of even being drunk is very low. And so is this what I want? Do I want to be considered a sober-minded person, or am I willing to give that up? When you drink, when you start drinking, you are willingly giving up your ability to be of sound mind and have sound judgment. And so it's something that God considers very important. Let's also look at Titus chapter 2. This is an interesting set of verses for me, because here he's addressing every age, and there's no age at which he does not consider this important. Titus chapter 2. And we start looking in verse 1, and he's teaching them, you speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. And then he tells older men are to be, my version says temperate. What does your version say, Lauren?
Sober.
Okay. And the King James Version also has sober. Chapter 2. Titus chapter 2, verse 1. And we're going to look through 1 through 6. So here the older men are told to be sober. Older women are also to be reverent in their behavior. Well, that's not the same word. Doesn't it carry the same idea? To be reverent, or to have good judgment, in your behavior. Okay, that's right. Mine says enslaved to much wine or given. They're going to ask me questions I can't answer. I do not know. There are people that believe wine is not the same, on the same level with other drinks. So I don't know. I did not really do the in-depth study on this, Amanda, so I really can't answer your question. I do know probably that in Italy, even some of the men we support, they probably drink wine. That's like water over there to them. But I don't know how what's been done to it to make the alcohol content. You know, a lot of times when you distill things and refine things, you can add things that make it more so. So I do not know. I cannot answer your question.
So much difference between new wine and, old wine, and its words used differently.
Well, I do not believe that the Lord, after everybody had well drunk, made more liquor. That just has always been one thing for me, that when you talk about wine, I'm not even sure that wine in the scriptures always includes any alcohol at all. It could just simply be grape juice. That to them, the fruit of the vine, the fruit of the grape was wine. So, But can you imagine everybody being half drunk? Because they had well drunk. It wasn't at the beginning. This was at the end of the feast when the Lord turned the water to wine. And here he made a whole bunch more, and it was better than the first. So whatever the first was, if it was alcohol, then this was too. So, but anyway, that's for another study. So here we have the older women, the older men, the older women. And then in verse 4, my version reads, so that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands and to love their children. But in the King James Version, it follows a different manuscript, and the first thing it says is so that they may encourage the young women to be sober. And, okay, you evidently have the King James. But then it goes on, even without that, in verse 5, to be sensible. Now, this sensible is not the same word that's translated sober, but they have very similar meanings, because they're translated. Sometimes sober can be translated different ways. And so,
is the first word in verse
5? Yes, to be sensible. What is your
discreet?
Discreet. Okay, yes, discreet or sensible. They're very, and I looked at the words, and they're not, they're kind of in the same family. They can be in the same family of words if you look at the numbers, Strong's numbers. That's the only way I know to do all that. So they're closely related, but not the same. But still, in the King James, it does say to be sober. So that there was a family of manuscripts that had that in there. So that's three classifications, the older men, the older women, and the young women. And then verse 6, likewise, urge the young men to be sensible. And that is translated sober in the King James Version. What is it in the New King James, Lauren?
Sober-minded.
So this is something that the Lord teaches us, and he stressed this. And it's throughout the scriptures, but this was one set of verses that it gets everybody. No matter what your age, the Lord expects you to be sober, sober-minded, to make good judgment, to keep your wits about you and do what the right thing. And so when you start drinking, you lose that. We say, all I drink, I'll hear people say, I just drink socially. I just drink, you know, at parties and that kind of thing. And we're going to deal with that more. The drinking parties is in the next word. But this is an area that you really need to stress with your children. Talk to your children. Get them to have an open dialogue with you about drinking and drugs, because I guarantee you this is something your children are going to face. I don't care how much you protect them. I don't care how guarded you think you keep them. At some point, they are going to be where you're not. They're going to have to. I know people who homeschool their kids for this reason. They think they can insulate them from some of these things. But sometimes that's harder, because when they go to college, then they're just bombarded with all of this stuff. Everything is so different, and you've not had time to combat some of that while you could do something about it. Okay, anything else on drinking before we move into the carousings and revelries? Okay, let's look at Romans 13:13, and this has both of our words in it. Doris, would you read chapter 13, verse 13 of Romans, please? So here's a whole group of words. Carousing is the way mine translates it. Drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, sensuality, strife, and jealousy. And it's interesting that several of the words that we've studied are in this group. But then verse 14 says, but. This is a not but construction. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. So my question would be, if I go to one of these, first of all, before we go too far, what definition did you come up with revelries?
Drinking, boisterous, wild party, or celebration.
Okay. Anybody else?
Festivity, you know, where a strong drink is.
Okay. Okay. And how many times, at least on television, that's the only drinking party I've ever seen, I've never been in one, how many times do they seem to get out of hand when they start the drinking, you know, and all this? And I'm sure Hollywood portrays it the way it is. I mean, they want that to look fun. They want you to participate in those kind of things. One definition I found in English was a lively drinking party. Lively, noisy enjoyment, especially with drinking and dancing. So here again, one thing, it's not just one thing. A lot of things get involved. You go, you start drinking, you start talking in ways that you never would talk to. I've heard people say that they've had friends tell them that they drank because it kind of, they felt like they were quiet and closed off, and it kind of opened up their inhibitions. Well, that's scary and dangerous. And so these kinds of parties, though, are the things that some of your children are going to be invited to. And that's why it's very important. I don't care if they're 16, 18 years old. Where are you going? Who's going to be there? What's going to go on there? What's going to happen? And it's interesting to me that even some people that I have known that were Christians would not miss a service, but didn't think that there was anything wrong with their child going to prom and to the party after prom. What is the party after prom? What do you think happens at those parties most of the time? If it's worldly people, I've known parents who bought the booze for their children. I mean, this is their kind of their rite of passage. And they're going to do it, and so I want to be in control of what they do, where they do it, how long it lasts, and all that. What kind of attitude is that? We need to teach our children this is something you flee from. You leave it alone. It's not something that you participate in at all. And that we're not to, and we're not to make them feel like they're missing out on something. They need to understand that they're very blessed to know not to do these things. I hear parents say, I'm so sorry for them. They just, I know as Christians, there's just so many things that their friends are finding is fun. And I've actually had people tell me this. And I'm standing there thinking, well, they're going to go and do exactly what you feel so sorry. When they're out from under you, they're going to go do the things that you think they're missing out on because you act like they're missing something. And they're not. They're not missing anything. All they're missing is a lot of heartache and trouble. When Lauren and...
Yeah, they want to fit in. That's what we hear. Well, their friends are doing it, and they don't want to be all that.
They want more than that. They want to be popular.
Exactly, popular.
They're going to push that, whatever they have to do, to get it talking.
I think it was when we did the class with the girls and found all those articles. I think there was an article in there that talked about how many young people lost their virginity on prom night because there'd been drinking and partying going on and that's,
everybody else is doing it.
Yeah, and that's the next progression is the sexual part of it. That's one of the inhibitions that you lose, evidently. Never drank, so I don't know. The closest I've ever come to drinking is grandma's cough syrup. So, yeah, well, that's true. I have taken that.
Just don't take before you go to work.
Yeah. Okay. And then it's interesting to me. Is there anything else on the carousing or drinking parties that someone wanted to mention? The interesting thing to me is the next thing in Galatians. And I don't think it's just pertaining to the set of verses the three words we're looking at. I think it's it's the whole deeds of the flesh and things like these. It encompasses all of these areas that we have looked at. So we must avoid everything we can so that we are not in the deeds of the flesh. There are two verses I want us to look at. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 10:14. Linda, would you read that, please? Okay, we had a whole section of words that we looked at that was on idolatry. And here, Paul just, in one swift statement, says flee it. Does that mean you have anything at all? When you're running away from something, are you trying to hold its hand? Are you trying to get as close to it as you can to participate in it, but not get caught up in it? Is that what picture you get when you're told to flee from something? No. If you say there's a fire, flee. What are you going to do? You're going to run as hard as you can to get away from there. Also, in 2 Timothy, Sandra, would you read chapter 2, verse 22, please?
Flee also, you full lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart.
Okay, it says flee youthful lust. Is it just young people sometimes that have youthful lust? Can you be 70 years old and still be tempted by sexual immorality? It happens all the time. People in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, once you hit 40 or 50 years old, do you have no more desire for things that young people might do and find fun that are questionable as far as God's concerned? I don't think so. But whatever this is, we're to flee from it. And here again, I think I've mentioned it before. I don't know if in ladies' class or not, but I've told some of you that Steve has a nephew that told us one time. He said, I want to walk just as close to the edge as I can be and still be pleasing to God without falling off. Well, you've already fallen off.
Mm-hmm.
When you're wanting to walk as close to the world and be as close to sin as you can get, because they're fun and things that you enjoy doing, then that is a very dangerous place to be. We need to flee from that and get away from it as best we can. I'm sorry, I got to check this because the last time that happened. No, it's still going. So these are things that we need to talk to our children about. And anybody that we can have influence on, Christian, other people's children, you're going to have other people's children in your home. Try to be a positive influence on them. Don't feel bad about talking to them if you know something that they're interested in. Don't betray a confidence of your child if they've talked to you about something, but try to find a way that you can influence that child. And if it's bad enough, talk to the parents. If you know they're drinking or they're, you know, there have been situations in churches where the kids were drinking and sleeping with one another, and all the kids knew it. And even the ones that weren't participating weren't going to tell on the ones who were. What is that? If you really love them and concern for their soul, you're going to try to do everything you can to save them. And people of the world, whatever influence we can have on them, maybe that will be an avenue to open a door for the gospel, drinking or sexual promiscuity or whatever. But things like these, even anger and hatred and the jealousy that goes on amongst people, that may be a door that we can use to open. You know, you don't have to have this in your heart. You can. There's peace. When you have Christ in your life and He's ruling your life, you can have peace. So these may be ways that we can use to open a door for the gospel. Okay, anything else before we go into the questions? I think we have time to do the questions. Linda?
I'll be quick. Proverbs 28:31 is longer.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite passage on drinking is Proverbs 23:29 and 3:35. And if you want to describe what drinking does, the uh-huh. Holy Spirit can tell you how it will affect you and the problem that you're going to have.
Uh-huh.
It's not mama said, it's not, you know, the Sunday school teacher. It's the Holy Spirit says, you know, it bites like a serpent, like a viper, yeah. And so it really, you know, and it goes through being in a stupor and seeing things and not being in control. But the Holy Spirit really puts it out in telegraphic language over there.
There's so many things in the book of Proverbs, if we would read that on a regular basis, that we could avoid and that we could be stronger, because that it is a book of wisdom, practical wisdom for everyday life, if we would just take advantage of it, whether it be raising our children or with our mates or whatever. Deanna? Yep, they do. And they'll go and do it again tomorrow. Okay, are there any of these that you think could never be a problem in your life? And we've asked this after each one, so we're dealing with these last three words. And, you know, I guess all of us sitting here could think, you know, drinking is something that doesn't appeal to me. I think it stinks. I've not even smelled any of it that I thought smelled good. I used to have a brother-in-law who drank a lot, and he always smelled bad. I mean, I didn't, you know, he'd come over, and of course, if he's been drinking, he really wants to hug on you, and I just wanted him to leave me alone, even when I was young. It's something we all can be tempted with. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. First Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. Sandra, did you read? I can't remember. Okay, Ida Sima, can you read 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11?
Yes. And these things happened to them as an example, and they were written support our instruction up until the end of the 8th of September.
Okay, we're not going to take time, but if you go back and read the first 10 verses, it's talking about the children of Israel and how they, how immoral they could be and all the things they did. And we think, how could those people do that? They had the 10 plagues. They had the Exodus. They had so many things that were just so glaringly evident that there was a God and that he was in control and that he loved them. Why would they? What, and we know idolatry was something they had trouble with from the day they came out of Egypt. They had it in Egypt and they brought it with them. And so go back and read in the Old Testament. If there are things that you don't think you could be involved in, go back and look at some of the things. Maybe one area would never tempt you, but something else might. And the next set of verses we're going to look at, to me, is very evident that we need to be very careful, because it's easy to say, it won't happen to me, I'll never do that. What was the attitude of Peter and really all of the apostles on the night that Jesus was betrayed?
Not me.
Not me. And we always want to look at Peter and kind of blame him for being, you know, this was something he could have done, you know, that he, why Peter? Why would he be picked out? Because he was so vocal about it. And sometimes we get very vocal about things we would never do, or my kid's never going to do. Be careful. They're going to eat your words. Deanna, would you read chapter 14, Mark 14, verse 29 through 31?
Peter said to him, "Even if all remains a stumbling, I will not be." And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me 3 times. But he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise.
So, you know, I think when we're the most vulnerable is when I think it can't happen to me. Anytime we reach a point to where we think, I can't fall away, I can't be tempted by that. As we've talked before, how many times have we known people who felt like that they would never be tempted by another person sexually and have left their mate, left the Lord? And it's rampant in the Lord's church. Elders and preachers sometimes are the worst. And you would think, of all people, elders and preachers would be insulated against that because they know better. No, knowing better is not enough. You've got to put in practice and be on guard every day, because the devil is just like that roaring lion out there. He's trying to find the weak one. You know, when a lion pride attacks something, they always try to attack the weakest or the smallest. And the devil knows where you're the weakest. It's when you think you're the strongest is sometimes when you are the weakest. Any other comments on the first two questions? Okay, let's look real quickly. Let's go back to Galatians. The last three questions we have are right here in the text that we've been dealing with. What does living by the flesh cause in our lives, according to these two verses?
Doing the things that you really didn't think you would do or even want to do, like you get into the passion at the moment and you do these things.
Okay, verse 16 and 17. Verse 17 says, "The flesh sets its desire against the spirit." So when you are living this way and you're living by the flesh, you're in direct opposition to the spirit. And that's a scary place to be. How would I ever want to be in direct opposition to my God? And the spirit is God. And the spirit here is put for the things that the spirit has taught us through the word. And we can't hold two things at one time. We're either walking by the flesh or we're living by the Spirit. Now, that's not to say that we don't have weaknesses and that we don't sin. But when you make your habit of life this according to the flesh, we're in opposition to the Spirit. And what is the condition of those who practice these?
Can I go back to that question?
Mm-hmm, sure.
I put that if you're walking by the flesh, you're not walking by the Spirit. And I know that.
I think that's
being direct opposite spirit, but it's not, you know, the walk by the flesh is the spirit's not there.
That's true.
In any way walking the way it's supposed to walk.
Okay. Right. basically, to me, that's saying the same thing, just kind of building on one another. It means the same thing. But yeah, we're either walking by one or the other. You can't walk both. You can't walk on the edge and hope not to fall off, because your foot's going to slip and you're going to be down the cliff. Okay, anybody else?
Well, as I go to 15, just one of the outgrowths of all those words that down below and everything is, you seem to consume one another. It says, everything you like by one another, it says consume from one another. And if you can even be consumed in and of yourself, I mean, the sand is one, and, you know, whether it's other people or yourself, your soul, it's going to have a soul.
Okay. What is the condition of those who practice this? Galatians 5:21. What? That is scary. Can you put that in one word?
Lost.
But I put the same thing you did, Sandra. Will not inherit the kingdom of God. You know, when you're expecting this big inheritance and you get nothing, only... You get, this case, it's not you don't get nothing or not anything. You get something very bad. You're either going to go to a place of rest or you're going to go to a place of torment. So it's not like, okay, I can live this way and I'm just going to go to sleep one day and I'll never know anything and I'll just be at peace. There won't be any more me. That doesn't happen. We have an eternal soul that is going to be lost. And if we do not inherit the kingdom of God, then we're going to live with the devil and his angels. So you've got to make a choice. It's one way or the other. You can't have both ways. And what have those who belong to Christ done with the flesh? We've put it to death. That's right. We have crucified it with its passions and desires. And so we have put it to death. That's no longer our life. That is no longer the way we want to live our life or to be known. I thank everybody for your participation and your help. I think since we only have one class before we're going to break for 2 weeks anyway, unless someone has an objection, we're not going to have class next week, because I really don't want to start the fruit of the Spirit and then have a break. This is a really good natural breaking point, and so we will just break here for the rest of this year, and my intention is, if everything goes well, is to pick up on, I think it will be the 9th. I think the kids go back to school that week, and sometimes we give an extra week, and if there's some reason to, we can talk about that, but if not, we will just pick up the week the children start back in school, which I think will be Wednesday the 9th, if I looked at it right.